brings us to our regular agenda, beginning with the safety report. Good morning, Mr. Cahill.
Good morning. I'm pleased to be presenting to you. I look at each board meeting as a reaffirmation of the commitment that my staff and I have towards the safety of the Metro riders and its employees. Everyone in Metro takes safety seriously, and I applaud the recent statements by Local 689 leadership reaffirming their commitment towards the improvement of safety at Metro. We are all working toward the same goal, to make Metro the safest and best workplace in the nation. Now on to the report. Overall, for rail safety and Metro access, indicators show a reduction in most categories, and the detail for the specific categories are found in Appendix A. For rail, again, some of the highlights are an increase in safety presence on all shifts, as well as safety meetings to ensure compliance and understanding of all safety procedures. Just as a recent example, the track work over Columbus Day weekend, we had safety officers signed over the entire weekend to ensure that our employees were working safely, and as you are aware, the track work was done successfully, thanks to Mr. Kubicek and his staff. In bus, in addition to the items noted here, Metro is continuing in conjunction with COG and the Street Smart campaign. This is a twice a year spring and fall pedestrian bicycle safety awareness campaign, and Metro is a partner in that effort. As a reminder to our operators, one of the low-tech, very effective ways our bus staff, they've created water bottles, and it has a logo on it, and it says, Metro, safety begins with me. This is a way of reminding them every day that safety begins with each of us at the beginning of their bus route. At our last meeting, Mr. Zimmerman, it was requested that we insert pedestrian and injuries and fatalities. This chart reflects the last two fiscal year and the year to date for the current year. It does not include the recent bus incident in October, as denoted below. That accident is still under investigation. In the future, we will move this chart to the appendices with the rest of the data to maintain this effort going forward. Metro access. The Department of Safety, along with Christian Kent and his department, have been assessing driver certification and addressing future refresher courses, as well as inspecting bus stops and rail intercoms for ADA compliance throughout the system. And that concludes my report. Thank you. I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions? I see some questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Next item is the police report.
And this morning, Assistant Chief Jeff Zielinski will be making the presentation.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'll be providing the Metro Transit Police crime statistics and significant facts report. First slide describes an attempt abduction arrest on September 5th, 2009 at the Huntington North garage. A suspect forced a female into his car, but she was able to escape. Contacted the station manager, who notified us. He quickly responded to the scene, helped identify the suspect, and were able to make the arrest within 24 hours of the incident. On September 9, 2009, we participated in the Northeast Corridor's Operation ALERTS. This stands for Allied Law Enforcement for Rail and Transit Security. This is a Northeast region-wide detail putting high-visibility officers in every transit property in that corridor. Over 100 police departments participated in that effort. On September 10th and 11th, we participated in a similar operation here in Montgomery County by putting high-visibility officers in every Metro Rail station in Montgomery County. At the request of the Pittsburgh Police Department, we sent 9 officers and a lieutenant to participate in the G20 summit detail that occurred on September 23rd, 24th, and 25th. The officers were selected by their supervisors for outstanding performance. When in Pittsburgh, they performed crowd control and venue security, and all costs associated with this detail were paid for by the city of Pittsburgh. The next slide depicts the T3 motion vehicle, which we also have in the back of this room behind me. We purchased three of these vehicles to be tested and evaluated in our system, particularly in our parking lots, such as New Carrollton, Franconia, Springfield. We rolled them out October 1st to coincide with the October Crime Prevention Month. In 2009, so far this year, we've had 47 bus operator assaults compared to 65 during the same time last year. Now, there's probably a number of factors that come into play for this reason, but we feel like the high-intensity targeted enforcement has been very effective at problematic bus routes and bus stops. In the significant facts category, probability of being a victim of a Part 1 crime in the Metro Rail system, Metro system overall, is 3.83 per million riders. In 2009, our police department has received over 39,000 calls for service, made over 1,300 arrests, issued over 4,000 criminal civil citations, and wrote over 3,000 fare evasion citations. This final chart here depicts Metro-wide crime as a system here versus our service area. And you can see in 2008, the actual numbers are 133,702 Part 1 crimes occurring in the jurisdictions that surround our metro system, as opposed to 1,821 Part 1 crimes that happen in our system. Next. Questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
Thank you. About these, what do you call these?
T3 vehicles.
T3 vehicles. You said you had three of them?
Yes, ma'am.
And you started rolling them out on October 1st at New Carrollton and Springfield.
Franconia, Springfield.
Franconia, Springfield, okay. And what did that entail? What were you?
Well, right now we're using them for regular patrol operations.
Okay.
We're putting officers on these to patrol those large parking structures and facilities in hopes that we're adding another layer of security to those parking structures.
So was this an all day? I mean, was this for what portion of the day or how often are you doing this? How often are you patrolling?
During normal business hours.
Okay.
In another couple of weeks, we'll evaluate these pieces of equipment. We'll survey the officers to see what they liked and disliked about the vehicles, and then we'll go forward from there.
Have you heard any preliminary?
Yes. Positive reports so far overall. These vehicles have a range of about 75 miles to be charged. The officers feel like they can cover more territory on foot, on a mountain bike for that matter. And the drawbacks that we've seen so far is that they're a little bit wider than your normal doorway, so storage becomes an issue. But overall, the officers seem to generally like them. Other police departments in this region are using them as well. Baltimore City has a few. I just found out yesterday that U.S. Capitol Police has 10 of them that they use. Now.
And the MTA in Baltimore also has a few of these units. In fact, that's when we first realized they were being used in the transit industry.
Okay.
It's in the meeting with them.
Thank you.
Okay. In the appendix, page 32 of 59, where you have the overall numbers of incidents, the robbery one, of course, is still troubling, the increase in the robbery one. So what are we doing during Crime Prevention Month to raise awareness? I know in the past we've handed out flyers and done different things, but what are we doing to raise awareness so that our riders know what they can do to protect themselves from robbery?
I'm glad you asked that question, actually, because there's five separate initiatives that the police department and Metro has undertaken to help curb the increase in robberies. First, we're making regular station announcements. There's a pre-recorded message that will be run every hour on the hours during normal business hours in the stations that will advise customers to safeguard their property and be aware of the circumstances that they're surrounded by. We have public awareness campaigns going on right now. October's Crime Prevention Month, and we're handing out that crime prevention literature at 14 metro stations this month, at least. We increased high visibility at Gallery Place, LaFont Plaza, and Metro Center. We've We continue to put officers out in plain clothes, called the robbery squad. So far, they've been very successful. Over 50 robbery arrests have been made by them since May. 96 robbery arrests have been made so far this year by the police department in general. And then finally, we are pursuing the issue raised last year by this board about the crime cameras. We actually went to Urban Area Security Initiative grant process to ask for money to put security cameras, those crime prevention cameras, at every station entering throughout the entire subway system. And that has preliminarily been approved as well.
Chief Walensky, I know we do this regularly. Could you distinguish again for us the difference between a larceny and a robbery, and tell us typically what are the larcenies that we see and what are the robberies that we see?
Yes. The larcenies are generally thefts. If I came over and took that water bottle, your water bottle off that desk right now, that would be a theft. If it was in your hand and I took it from you, it would be a robbery. Okay, so the difference there is the actual possession. And there has to be some degree of force used to commit a robbery. Theft is generally without force. And those larcenies that you see on the statistics generally include thefts from autos as well, parking facilities.
So what you're saying is larcenies are largely people stealing GPSs out of cars, things like that?
Not just GPSs, but hubcaps, car parts, tires. Happens on occasion, but it's not just GPS. Sometimes cars get broken into. Mm-hmm. Laptop computers taking, small electronic devices.
Okay. So if somebody steals a hubcap, that's a larceny.
Correct.
And the robberies are largely iPods and cell phones and things like that?
Correct.
Okay. So when we say there's an increase, it's not an increase in people pointing guns at somebody and saying, give me all your money. It's more people stealing iPods.
You're exactly right. Most of our robbery cases are those robbery snatches. People would run up and grab something out of someone's hand and take off running, sometimes making good their escape. Others are pickpockets as well. Mm-hmm. But okay. Largely, our robberies do not include aggravating factors such as extreme force or weapons.
Okay, thank you.
Is there any way that you get access to any data that gives you an idea of this sort of thing, you know, more broadly than just the territory that you're specifically responsible for? For instance, you know, the kind of thing you were talking about, the, you know, larcenies, for instance, involving, you know, parking facilities. Is there any way to compare that overall with all the other parking facilities and the larcenies that may occur on them?
What we do compare crime statistics against is that of the local jurisdiction. And the local jurisdictions don't distinguish between parking facilities and shopping malls or in schools or libraries or anything like
larceny
that. So it's
larceny.
Very difficult. Larceny is a larceny. Yeah. When it comes to the robberies, that's really a focus of our attention these days. What we're seeing on the West Coast is an increase in thefts of North Face jackets and a new jacket that's called a Spider or something along those lines. So in anticipation of that trend happening here in our system, our undercover robbery squad has purchased a couple North Face jackets they will use to set up as decoys. In case that trend happens here, we would be able to be ahead of that curve instead of behind it.
But, I mean, that's a case where your trend is focused on a specific article that for right. Which there's really some market. But if you wanted to know, you know, the degree to which, say, automobiles are being targeted, it's harder to get that, I guess.
It is difficult to get that.
Because that, you know, that's, it's interesting to see, you know, the trends and all that, and that's clearly, because of the nature of the property we have, that basically seems to be the focus of crime, or crime occurs, that it's in our property, it's basically in the parking areas. But it'd be nice to have some kind of context for what's going on, and particularly for just the sort of thing you're talking about, if you had some way of knowing on a region, and all the police forces had some way of knowing. As it happens, a member of my family was recently the victim of such a crime, not at a metro place, but at a shopping mall. And, you know, car broken into, things stolen, and, you know, you just wonder if there's any way that they can trace. I mean, you know, when things happen for houses, it's very geographically traced, right? And they can pick up that there's something happening here, and then there's some hope of, you know, catching somebody. This strikes me as a large area that's a target of opportunity for criminals that by its nature may be harder to, you know, kind of centralize the information on because, you know, we have a bunch of parking garages, shopping malls and parking garages, office parks, you know, there's all these different places. They're mostly not, you know, public property in the usual sense. They're not, you know, part of the city's streets or something like that. And they're not under one owner. And I wonder whether there shouldn't be something done to try and, you know, get cooperation so there could be better information and better, you know, tracking and targeting in that area.
That's an interesting point that you make, and we are involved pretty densely with the Council of Governments here in this region. I'll bring that up before a couple of the committees and see if we can figure out a way to get that information. That certainly help us.
It's interesting to me, but I was really more interested in how people in your line of business might be able to make use of it in your work. Anyway, thank you. Other questions? Oh, I did have one other one. I gather that vehicle, I mean, it's, you could have said we have people in cars, we have people on foot. This seems to be like something in between. So there's a reason you were going for something like this. Can you tell me the kind of considerations that went into saying it's not enough to use the cars we have or to have people on foot in another way?
Well, we're always looking for additional layers of security. Certainly with over 50% of our Part 1 crimes being in the parking facilities, the efforts that we do have, one could say, may not be as good as we would like them to be. We're always looking for new initiatives to see if we can bring down the number of Part 1 crimes, particularly in our parking facilities. When other departments started using these vehicles and they provided us with positive feedback and we were able to test and evaluate them on a small scale, ride them around and kind of kick the tires a little bit, we saw some positive advantages in these, such as the fact that they're highly visible, they have a headlight on them for low visibility in the garages and so forth, they have these lights on them and so forth, they have storage. So all these things you look at and say, if we make this investment, will it be able to pay off in the terms of lowering our crime in the parking lot? We don't know if that's going to occur yet because we haven't had them long enough.
Right.
Certainly, if we do see there's a utility here, we'll look to purchase more of them and hope to continue the downward trend in crime.
But the question, I guess, then, what you're trying to evaluate is, does it increase the presence of, well, you know, the apparent presence that an officer is seen in more places, in fact?
I believe so. The officers have told me that they are patrolling more now than they would have on foot on mountain.
Expands their range.
Yes, expands their range. These have a range of 75 miles. Of course, an officer's not going to be on them for 75 miles at a time, but in a big parking facility like New Carrollton, for instance, where there's a couple different garages, two sides, several different parking lots, that's a lot of ground to cover. And if the officer's able to continually patrol on this throughout their shift, you know, hopefully would be able to prevent, deter, or maybe even capture some of the criminals that are in our parking lot. Just that, in short, our officers are on their patrol assignments longer using equipment like this. That's what we want.
And I take it they're electric.
Yes, these are electric
powered vehicles.
Zero emissions, and the marketing people tell me that it only costs about 10 cents a day to operate these things. I find that, you know, hard to believe, but we'll find out.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Ms.
I just wanted to comment on that because in Fairfax, our police departments in some areas have acquired what used to be golf carts from the parking lot. And what happened was it made areas where the criminals or perpetrators were more likely to believe they could not be found. And it started a deterrent. For example, you get on a pathway and commit a crime, it's really hard, as you say, even on the bikes, and focused it. And so I think also that the radius of how far you can go is changed, and it kind of signals something. And our garages often are just mainly targets. People know, you get in a car and you're gone, and the officer gets there alive.
Good to see what the results are.
Right.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Item C is the report on the work that was done over the Columbus Day weekend. Mr. Francis, you handling this one?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. Members of the committee, as reported in the last committee, I wanted to give you an update on our Columbus Day activities. as you well know, we closed our service from Navy Yard to Gallery from that Friday night to 5 a.m. that Tuesday morning on the 13th. Our main focus was to do our annual Yellow Line Bridge inspection and also to do some work at LaFont Plaza interlocking. But we were changing our switches over to number 8 guarded switches. But while we were doing that, we also took advantage of replacing about 585 feet of rail, some fasteners and some insulators, as well as anchor bolts. Took advantage of also doing some relamping at the station lights, as well as doing some work in the right-of-way as well. We estimated that this shutdown would have saved us about 132 days of single tracking, and just as important, it generated savings of approximately $500,000.
How many days of single tracking?
132.
In other words, if you had not done this over the weekend the way you did, which obviously severely limited the service on the weekend, and tried to do it, in a shorter number of hours, you would have been spread out over 132 days.
Exactly, and the way that we used to do some of this work was we used to do it in 4 consecutive weekends, which would have been even more time. So that's part of the estimate that we put in here, and we'll single track for those weekends. Exactly.
Why don't you just briefly, succinctly tell people what a fastener is, what an anchor bolt is, some idea what these things are.
Okay, and we thought you would ask that question. So Mr. Kubitschek has bought the
good.
To show you, Mr. Kubitschek has bought the visionaries.
Just so okay.
We're going to have to show and tell.
Correct. Yes, sir. Okay, this is basically, this is your track pad that we utilize. This is a new design.
Okay, have a track pad means the track is actually laying on that.
The track sits right on there. It right in here, right where my hand is at. And basically, this basically sits right on top of concrete or concrete pads. These are stud bolts. Whenever you hear about stud bolt fires or anchor bolts, this is the device. And basically, whenever these things fail, literally the return current through the grid literally melts and catches this on fire and burns the material.
Okay, but this is what's holding that thing.
It goes like this.
That's holding that down and track it.
This goes into the concrete. So staff has to core drill out concrete, reform epoxy in. They establish the bolt. Then they come in, they put the pad on top of the new concrete fixture. Then you go back and you reinstall the rail back here in this area right in here. Instead of using other traditional bolts, this is called like an E-clip. And basically it gives the track a little bit more, a panel clip, whatever you want to call it. Basically it goes in and it slides and it torques down. And you don't have to worry about doing additional bolts. And it gives the rail more flexibility and movement.
But that's what's actually pinning the rail to the pad.
That is correct. With this new technology.
Okay. Now, the bolts that you just showed, and make sure you understand, you're saying that over the weekend they replaced 1,200 of those?
Yes. Yeah. We have to core through concrete. Repour, reform, allow it to dry. So whenever you only have a 2 or 3 hour window, you can see why you don't get very many done, because you have to do all the extraction, and literally sometimes the rail has to be ripped up or cut out and removed. So this is why this is so valuable. If I could, I'd like to show you a sample of what we are taking out.
Please.
Now mind you, this is an original installation. And this is different technology that we use right now. This is what they look like out there now after 20 to 30 years worth of use. The other thing I want to point out, you notice there is a crack from one side to the next. By us doing this work, this is what prevents us from having catastrophic failure. And with us doing new inspection criteria, new work, for example, some of the areas that we focused on the aerial structure, where we're pulling up out of the portal, we're putting super elevation, going grade, where we're putting a lot of stress. These are areas of the railroad that I'm focusing on to make sure that we address first. The tangent track, we're probably in okay shape, but this just kind of gives you an idea. It hasn't went all the way through, so it goes to show that the inspection and the maintenance and stuff that we're working on, but if we do not get out there and address these things, we will have other issues.
Very good.
And also, if I'd like to point out, is that if you notice, this design has a slot, So this has bolts that hold the rail versus this new E-clip design as well. And this right in here, once it's knocked in and stayed in, it's very secure. This helps reduce our maintenance because we don't have to go back and have to re-torque stuff all the time. And there's a lot of extra stresses added. And if you also notice, this pad where this sits is a lot thicker than what this one does right in here. So it gives us a better point, and we don't have less weak areas on the design.
You've now piqued some interest in this. You look at
the the other one, the newer bolt?
Yes.
Yeah, no, not that one. The other little round thing. What do you call that?
The E-clip.
The E-clip. Yeah, thank you. The E-clip. So that you said that allows greater flexibility?
Yeah. Basically, this is a hardened torsion steel. And there's a little flat area right in here. So whenever staff installs it, they take a sledgehammer and they knock this thing into place. And there's a lot of torque. And what it does is just gives a little bit better movement because the rail expands. You know, it's just like with expansion joints and stuff move. So with this being the design, it lets it slide. Whenever you have a bolt design with a clip and stuff, it's sitting there wobbling and moving that back and forth. So that creates other maintenance
issues. It creates more stress and whatnot.
Pardon?
And without having that, that's what adds to the additional stress.
Yeah, this adds more stress. Yeah. This makes it more fluid. And it's something that we've changed since I've been here, you know, moving forward in different designs, looking at different technology to incorporate, just to make the system more robust.
Did you find lots of old equipment like that with cracks and things?
We do find equipment like this as we're going through these campaigns and as we're monitoring this stuff.
So
this one is the more severe. You might find some stuff with some smaller items, but I just picked this one out because it was very graphic.
It's very graphic. So clearly then it was imperative that we go in and make all these changes.
Absolutely. And also, if you notice, this one is not covered with a pad with insulation material. Either that or it's peeled off over the years, and then there's pitting and stuff underneath there. With that, with this being part of the return current or the return grid, that we're wasting electricity and stuff as well, because it also is part of the return process of the rail.
Okay. Well, I guess then to dovetail on the chair's comments, then since it was imperative that we make these changes and there's no way of getting around inconveniencing our customers, it was better than to inconvenience people for a much shorter condensed period of time than for the 132 days that it would have taken otherwise.
And also that's why these programs are so very important, is that we can, you know, you get 2 or 3 hours to do this type of stuff, but whenever we're able to come in there and blitz things for 48 hours or 72 hours and stuff, these are the heavy duty type of things that we're going after. We're not going after lightweight stuff that we do day in and day out. And it's just mission critical for us to keep up with the system.
Thank you.
Mr. McKay.
How old did you say that was again?
This pad here was original. It's probably between 25 and 30 years old.
Okay, and what is the life expectancy of the new pads?
The new pads, 30 to 40 from what we've been told. Possibly, you know, about the same. But this design, like I said, is a lot thicker, a lot more robust. And you don't really know, you know, they can do all this simulation with age and everything else, but you got to install it. But just by design, this is more robust for us.
And do you have any idea what percent of our rail area has been upgraded to that product?
Not off the top of my head. I know that we started doing patches. I've got staff. It's a fundamental shift of what's taking place here beforehand. So like the work that we did over the Labor Day weekend, we went in with the same mentality and same mindset. You know, if we also like changed out rail, you know, 2,000 feet of double track. So I can spend time looking back. We pads, we have hundreds of thousands of these things, you know, all over the place. And like I said, my focus is aerial structures, gradient, curve, where the most aggressive stress is on the system. The tangent track, we'll get it whenever we can get it, you know, but these are our areas that I'm prioritizing right now.
Okay, it would be nice to see at some point, you know, overall, what area have we covered, because that's a great graphic, and it's scary to see that. So it would be nice to know, you know, overall in the rail system, where have we gone in, made these upgrades? I mean, you're talking about something that could last 30 years. That's a long time.
Yeah.
So it would be nice, at least for me, to know, you know, what percent of our overall rail area have we gone in and made this upgrade to, just as a peace of mind?
And the flip side of that is, what is it we have yet to do that needs to be done? Yeah. So I think seeing something like that would be useful for everybody and help make some of the points that General Manager is trying to make about the need for capital funding. These devices, though, these are all for areas that are basically on concrete and therefore likely.
We still use this design also on wood ties as well.
So on the tie and ballast, yeah, on the exterior parts, you have the same kind of ballast?
Yeah, we would have the same kind of thing. Probably a different way of adhesing it, you know, where they might use like a railroad spike. There's a little bit difference, but we do different pads with clips. You know, we are introducing different things here. I'm not staying with the past older technology. You know, one, we want to get stuff that's readily available that other railroads are using throughout the world. And so that way, you know, the design's improved, so we want to capitalize on that.
Thank you. Very useful. Francis, okay.
Okay, just to piggyback on what Ms. Kupacek was talking about, from a customer standpoint and the benefits to the customer, it improves the system reliability and have fewer delays, as Dave pointed out, if we don't address some of these situations when we're doing our campaigns, that it could have some issue on the system. And from a customer standpoint as well, as they should see a better ride quality when you replace X number of feet of rail and you're operating over that same section now from the old to the new, you should see some ride quality. Minimizes the long-term impact to the customers. That's what I mentioned earlier, Mrs. Zimmerman, that we used to do this in 4 weekends, and now we've minimized it and taken advantage of the long weekends. Reduces the cost of repairs and extends the life cycle of equipment, and that's going back to the 4 weekends, moving equipment back and forth. Also, we took advantage of patching up some leaks that were in the stations as well. So we had an opportunity, once we were able to take some of these stations out of service, to do that and upgrades to the future cell phone infrastructure.
Okay. Go back. Okay, this is the work and stuff that took place underground. This is just north of LaFont. Basically, we replaced, you know, all the switches. We replaced these pads, for example, what we showed you here. The staff went in and cut all this stuff out, boarded out, poured new concrete. This was all original installation. And so the crossovers were replaced, the switch points were replaced, guarded rail was installed, new switch machines restored across the board, which is a huge, huge effort. And as you can see, very tight dynamic envelope for staff to work, so you really have to cut this stuff out, extract it, and then everything has to be very, very, you know, exact. Next slide, please. This gives you an idea of whenever we shut down the bridge on what's taking place. This is our equipment that we're having to utilize. This some of this equipment we're going to need to work on upgrading and such. This equipment is not only used for this type of activity here underneath the bridges and stuff, but of all the aerial structures and stuff that we work through, we use this equipment on a regular basis. We're really getting very aggressive in this maintenance because, you know, we're at 30, 35 years on some of these structures. So we're really pushing forward, as you can see, you know, stuff moving back. Now, I can't comment at whose boat that is on that there. I'd have to ask staff on that one right there, but that's a few that I've got. But we primarily try to stay on the tracks in our working area through there. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dave. You know, at the last committee meeting and conversation with our general manager, internal staff, communication was a big issue. And we worked extremely hard on this project to make sure that we've got the word out to both internally and externally to our customers on the work that was going to be done and the alternatives that our customers had as well. So I just wanted to share with you that some news releases went out on the dates that you see on the screen. The 8th, 28th of September was a press conference held on October the 1st to discuss what was taking place, the stations closed, the hours, and so forth. There was 90 customer service representatives from staff, take ones. There were a number of take ones at the station, as you can see, signage, pit signs, and so forth. I want to take this opportunity because I really do think this was a good team effort, and I want to put our customers as part of that team too, because through their patience, cooperation, and suggestions on some, and even in the committee meeting we had last time, I know, Mr. McKay, your comments stood out about a shuttle that showed up, and you know, we didn't coordinate that well, and we left some of the personnel there. Well, out of that, you know, what we end up doing this time is we had at least daily conference calls each day, maybe twice a day to go over what happened the day before, to that we have to make any adjustments and suggestions that came from our field supervisors. And we did a lot of different coordination. Mr. Kubitschek was sitting there for the, I guess, the 3 days with help from a lot of our internal team to make sure that that happened and that we didn't repeat what happened before. And more importantly, to try to get the communication out. And we did that to everyone. And we included, hopefully you guys got some of the information that was going on for that weekend just to keep everybody abreast of what was going on. From a bus shuttle standpoint, we had over 2,200 shuttle trips operated, moving about 64,000 of our customers that weekend. As I mentioned before, we had our service managers, our bus operators all involved. Our transit police did an exceptional job of coordinating with the operating department. So as I mentioned before, it was a total team effort from everybody. And even from an internal standpoint, I would say this. We had monthly meetings internally, but those monthly meetings went into weekly meetings to get prepared for all of this. What could happen, the possibilities, if there were service interruptions or things moving. So we did from everybody's standpoint, did a great job in that. And I just wanted to thank Mr. Kubitschek for kind of ramrodding that as well. And I think he wants to acknowledge a couple of our internal employees who also did a pretty good job.
Okay. If I could, first I could thank Mr. Leroy Jones. He's with Bus Transportation. Please stand up. This is the gentleman that was with us the whole way through as far as our conference calls. We started out Friday night, and then our calls that we were at the command center here, making sure that everything switched, everything worked correctly. Multiple folks that were here, but then we had calls at 8:30 and 5:30 every day all the way up through the process because we were looking at events that were going on, logistics, resources that need to be reutilized, and he was our primary contact for bus operations, and he just did a marvelous job.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Just a marvelous job. And then I also have Doug Gibson. Whenever you look at the aerial structures out there, all this work and stuff that's taking place on the deck and stuff, this is the man right here.
You actually out on the thing hanging under there?
No. It was for in case there was an accident with that equipment, and those employees fell into the water, that boat was there to rescue them.
Yeah. See, that's why I brought the rock. Okay, so from a structural standpoint, touching this stuff, you know, he's involved as part of this process, even the logistics, you know, just to get this effort, you know, undertaken. The other person I could recognize is Mr. Paul Bumbry. Some stuff that we've shifted in rail operations is I've got also a focus where we're shifting towards line management of the railroad, but also management of the stations. The stations for me are a very critical component of this from a communication based standpoint. Paul is part of that team, the new team that's coming on board, and his job is to really focus on what is taking place at the actual stations, you know. And so we're going through a learning curve and effort and stuff, but when it got into signages and MIPS and any type of resources, Paul was the go-to person, so he was very invaluable.
Thank you, Mr. Rumber.
And then Mike Brown. Okay, this is the gentleman here whenever you saw the crossover work that was done underground in the tunnels. This has never been done here before in the history of this agency in this short of a time frame. This is the gentleman who architect and put this stuff together, put the plan and stuff together, and from a logistics standpoint of the signaling staff, the powering staff, the infrastructure and everything else, this is the gentleman that was down there that was making this stuff happen as well. And, you know, for us to achieve this amount of work in that short of a time frame versus all these outages and stuff, it's really very, you know, it's very spectacular. Like I said, his dedication with him and his team was what made this successful. And we had, you know, no issues, no follow-up type items and stuff. And he was able to hand over products so that way other departments could work to complete their stuff. So, again,
thank you very much.
Person there.
My impression of this work.
Thanks for having me.
My impression that this went a lot more smoothly. I mean, obviously people have different experiences, but I do think the communications effort was much more successful this time than the last time, and I think as a result things were better received.
Yeah.
All things important to explain to people, as you've done this morning, kind of what's going on.
Yeah.
So there's more understanding of, you know, why there is any interruption ever.
If I could, I'd also like to thank the police department, emergency management component of that well, as well as media, because they were also active participants, not only leading up to this, but also during the course of these conference calls. We also had a post-review, and so a lot of the things we're planning are months and months in advance, and so we also came out of this with some post-items as we start planning and looking ahead into calendar year 2010 and other areas as well. So my thanks to them as well. And there was a lot of other people as well.
So what's next?
At this stage, we don't have anything really major planned for calendar year 2009. Actually, we've kind of ran out of materials, and so we're having to wait to get stuff ordered, and then we'll start looking at possibly what we can do around in January time frame. But it'll be based on materials.
I wanted to thank you because I think it was on Friday, a customer and someone I know called and said, well, you know, I've looked at everything on the website as to what information I need, but I'm really apprehensive. And on Tuesday, they called to say I should not have been apprehensive, that the interruptions were minimal and that everybody was there. And I think often we get very riled up because we're expecting the worst. Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, the customers can't see all of the detail there, but it's the final delivery that makes the difference to them. And I was amazed because we anticipated that we would hear from the customers and they'd tell us what they thought, and they did, and it was very good. So I want to congratulate you. Another piece I'd like to ask, and I think it was similar to what I think Mr. Zimmerman may have raised or someone, but it would really be good when you go back to this data to see how much more and how far we are, to start graphically displaying this to the customers, because they can't see this. Mm-hmm. We know that it's the entire operation that works that gives them that positive outcome, but it makes a difference. We sit in awe of it, but I think when they can make the connection that what portions of a rail line have changed from the old to the new, and what they experienced on that Columbia holiday is important. Otherwise, I think we're missing the opportunity to connect them with what the system does for them. Otherwise, they see it small, and it's not a small piece.
Yeah, that was Mr. McKay's suggestion, and I do think it's going to be important for us to be able to track what's going on and, as you say, communicate more broadly.
Keep them on our side.
Yeah, I will echo Supervisor Hudgens' comments. One, the customers I heard from, some of them traveled over the Labor Day closure, and they also traveled over Columbus Day, and they told me that the measure of success for them was their delay was minutes and not hours, and that makes a huge difference, and they expect minutes delays. I mean, they expect inconveniences for that. It's the hours that they didn't plan for before, and I think it's a testament to the better job we did communicating and handling the logistics of this. The one thing I wanted to add to what Kathy mentioned is, you know, this is pretty highly technical work, pretty hard to explain to customers. What isn't hard to explain to them is the number of hours that we would have had to close down had we not done this when we did. It's a this hours versus this hours. That's not hard to explain to people, and that would be something that I think would be worthwhile to get across to our customers. The other part of this that we talked about with these pads and their life expectancy of possibly 30 years is that this is a once in every 30-year event, that we're going in doing significant work to buttress the system we have. This is not the same piece of track we're going to have to come back in 12 months from now and do again. Because the impression is that this is just, we're tearing it up, we'll be back a year or two from now doing it again, and that's not the reality of how long these things last. So two things that are easy for customers to understand is how long this work we're doing is going to last the system, and more importantly, because of when we strategically did it, how many hours of downtime have we saved? And if we could communicate that better with them in the future, I think that would be good.
Very good points. I'd say we had a large number of people from my family in from out of town that weekend, and I remember thinking, they're all coming in, they're going to think they want, you know, while they're here, they want to go to the museums and all that stuff, and I just know I'm going to get, you know, all kinds of grief, you know, about And I have to say, I actually didn't say anything to them about, you know, you might have a problem. I didn't say anything, and nobody complained. So, you know, I'm sure people, somebody had a miserable experience out there that weekend on any given day with hundreds of thousands of riders. But my impression from not just myself, but, you know, from a large number of people who were in, from out of town in my family was it seemed to go pretty good. So please don't see that. Ms. Hewlett.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Francis and Mr. Kubitschek. I, too, would like to extend my congratulations. I think we did a lot of things right in this instance, and it was the difference of night and day from Labor Day to this Columbus Day weekend. And as we said, as Mr. McKay said, the 48 hours versus 132 days of single tracking is seriously night and day, and that's a good point to bring home. But I think you did a lot of things right in terms of the weekly meetings, trying to anticipate in advance, doing all that troubleshooting, and having those 88 additional people at the station to help out, having those 88 people on hand to help out and help those customers who in need and to make it smooth. So thank you, and thanks to all of you who were there and participated in part of that.
Very good. Thank you, Francis. Thank you. I believe we have one more item on our...
Yes, we do.
Sir Wilson and Ms. Peck. Sarah Wilson and Suzanne Peck will do the next presentation, Mrs. Zimmer.
This is about transit scheduling data and the reports on what's been happening since we made data generally available and what we might be doing in the future and answers to some questions that members have had.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Good morning. Today we're going to talk about our access to transit scheduling data, including our trip planner and information that developers use, as well as information that may be available on Google. I know there's been a lot of attention about Google Transit and how other transit properties have used Google Transit successfully, and we are anxious also to participate in Google Transit as well. At this point, we have a few legal issues to overcome, including the indemnification issue, but we're confident that we'll be able to negotiate through that, and so I'm here today to express that to you, that we do anticipate that in the near future we'll be establishing a partnership with Google Transit. To start off, I just wanted to point out a few things about our trip planner.
Ask a question. Can I ask a question?
Feel you need to clarify something at
this point. Yeah. Sue said in the very near future we'll have Google Transit available. How near is the near future? Is it a modest near future or?
It's as soon as we get agreement on this indemnification.
Could that be 2 weeks, 2 months, years?
It depends on how we can negotiate this indemnification. So that's the only thing that's really holding us back. I can tell you this. When we did at Mr. Zimmerman's request, we sent out letters to every other Google Transit property that's been on their list. We received copies of two agreements back, one of which, as Mr. Zimmerman had pointed out, did not include an indemnification clause. So the fact that Google has already agreed with another transit property on this issue that's holding us back leads me to believe that we similarly would not have such an issue with Google. So we have precedent, in other words, that this issue has been able to be resolved with Google in the past. Have confidence that we can resolve it as well on our side. The trip planner, which has been which we've had in several forms, most recently enhanced by the efforts of Peck and her team, which is the most popular part of our website. Most people who come to our website go to it because of our trip planner. And this is a place where they can get accurate information, fare information, schedule, where they can make help themselves make decisions about their trip. And that sometimes when they go to their information in, it leads to next pages, which also include advertising, which also brings in revenue. And I'll get to that a little bit later. The second slide just goes through all the itinerary, goes through all the assets the Trip Planner provides and. Did you want to? You can find them in the planner. Okay. So we have a detailed itineraries, lots of information on buses and rails, on rail stations. We also include elevator and escalator outages. You can find walking directions. as well as the fares, and you can also customize as far as how much you want to walk or don't want to walk. So it has a lot of flexibility. Our website, on the next slide, our website also offers tremendous more amount of information now. Under Ms. Peck's leadership last year, I believe, we did a major refresh of our website, and it is more in line with what the state of the art is. In fact, we had many comments from folks remarking at how this looks more like a private company than a public government agency. And so now you have headlines. It's more user-friendly. Real-time bus, which of course was the next bus process that Ms. Peck also led. The bus maps, detours, and things of disruptions. Those kinds of things are very readily available to our customers. The next slide just the details of how much money we're bringing in web advertising. We are the only major transit system in the country. And possibly internationally. I know London does not also, they also do not have web advertising on their website. But we do, and it brings in, since its inception, it's brought in $200,000 in revenue. In the grand scheme, maybe not as not a huge amount of money, but it's one thing that requires almost no staff time to monitor or to oversee. So it's, and it's been steadily increasing. We expect it to exceed last year's numbers at the pace that we're going. Next slide. The other component to our transit scheduling data is that we provide it for free to anybody who wants it. And so as a result of our providing this information for free, a number of companies, private companies, have taken this information and have developed applications for the iPhone, for example, to turn it into products that the public may be interested in doing. And I think we can go to that. Show you an example of one company called iTrans, which makes their product available to iPhone owners, and that of course those are folks who have AT&T. But this is it. If you wanted to purchase this, iTrans can make that available, and for 99 cents, you can get the application and have it forever on your iPhone.
This just to clarify, this is since last spring when the data was released.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
This is since about April of 2008, and after, I think.
The table you've distributed.
A list of about 24 applications, iPhone applications, that have been developed since about April of 2008, and with a now increased rapidity, almost virtually all of them give schedule data for Metro Rail, virtually all of them give map data, a very few of them give bus data. Very occasionally, they're also giving service disruption and elevator disruption information, and about half the time, they're giving trip planner information. The price of these are relatively modest applications by relatively small companies, and the pricing for these applications is between occasionally free, but generally between $1 and $4.
Do we have any way of tracing the amount of traffic that they're tracking?
On these, no.
Okay.
These are, the data out freely, as Sarah said, and they take it, use it, have their own statistics, but we have no into their statistics. Individual companies.
Related follow-up, in our Google application and our Google contract negotiation, we will be able to track the number of hits.
Yes.
We will be able to track the number of hits that are tracked to our site through Google.
Yes. And I think Sarah's going to show you in a minute or two Denver's co-location, their trip planner, and the Google Trip Planner, and instantly as she told you, we are waived from indemnification by Google. It's our intention to put up something on our site that looks exactly like that, that has companion applications, and so riders may choose either the Google or ours. Ours have some advantages, but some riders may have a preference for...
Well, why don't we get that so we can see?
Oh, yeah, we're going to go to the Denver site right now. On the Denver site, on the right-hand side, upper right-hand side, right under that yellow banner, you see that customers have a choice between choosing either Google's transit for their trip planning or RTD's own trip planner. And either one of those two will give customers what they need as far as the directions and what line to take. Some of the things that Google can't provide for in our instance, but that we can provide, would be things like fare information and any disruptions. But some, as Ms. Peck pointed out, some folks may have a preference for Google, and so this is how we would propose to incorporate it on our own site as well.
And to your question, we can follow the statistics of both of, be able to follow the statistics of both of those. Currently, year to date on our trip planner, have about 25 million itineraries planned, about 600,000 itineraries a week are currently being planned on Metros.
On the other...
So you'll be able to track them when you get to the centralized site directly versus those that come to you?
Yes.
On the and to illustrate Ms. Peck's point of just about how attractive our website is, also on the second handout that you received is a list of other transit properties, and talks about how each of those properties uses Google Transit. And on the third column, it says a ranking among U.S. websites. Basically, the lower the number, the better position you're in. And so you can see New York City has is the highest ranked, and this is the list of all the websites that exist in the United States, registered in the United States, and where that transit property's website fits in that whole universe. So New York's is first with 1,056. New Jersey Transit, not surprisingly, is number two, and then we are number three with that, with 4,249th place there.
That looks like it's pretty much a measure of how big the city is.
Possibly that, yeah, because it's certainly not ridership, because we are New Jersey Transit, New York, Chicago, they're higher than us on ridership.
No, I think she's getting close, though.
So, yeah, back to the presentation. Next slide just shows how some of our area partners are already on Google Transit, Alexandria, Fairfax, and Loudoun, and we are hopeful that the rest of our transit partners will also be joining us, because that would also be helpful for integrating the whole experience for the customer who would be choosing Google Transit.
My understanding is if Metro gets on, most of these are going to be on.
I don't know that.
A lot of goes on, that's probably okay. The vehicle for which. I know, well, at least one board, so that would be true.
Okay.
Well, since you have the data, I mean, since...
Well, each individual agency is responsible for providing their own data. So
I would confidently predict that if Amana makes an agreement, you'll see all the rest of them get on fairly quickly.
That would be good. And so just in conclusion, we've talked about the transit planner, how robust that is, and it's very helpful to our customers, that Google Transit, as well as other developers, can currently download our scheduling files, and that we make our scheduling files available in these formats that are applicable to developers. Our next steps are moving forward with an agreement, and I don't know that it's going to be an interim agreement. I think that may be inaccurate, but an agreement with Google Transit, assuming we can overcome this major issue of the indemnification, and we look forward to doing that.
Ms. Gray.
Yeah, I just have 2 points quickly. Number one, would it be helpful for us to set a deadline so that we could have, you know, some direction from the board in terms of saying we'd like to have some action by a particular day. Would you find that helpful or unhelpful?
I
find it helpful. Okay. The second thing is that...
Mr. Graham, if I could, before you move on, I think the question is, would the people on the other side of the table be operating under a similar deadline?
That's fine. Yeah, well, I mean, we can't control that.
where we can.
But the concern I have is I've been on the staff side of the table, as you know, and the board has a couple of times given me a deadline. And when the people on the other side know that I have a deadline and they don't, they know that they can negotiate in a way that makes it harder for me.
Well, I mean, we're not going to have a public execution if they don't meet the deadline. You know, we can have
that's too good to have.
We can have a.
It's just you don't want to adversely affect the bargaining position of your folks.
Right.
You know, I'm as strong an advocate for this as anybody, but you know, I do want to be sure that you know what we wind up with is something that is on terms no less favorable than anybody else has gotten. And part of the reason I push this hard is because we found out that indeed that the provision that was raised as most objectionable here was excised from those of some other agencies. So there's no reason to think that Google would be willing to do that for us also. But I also don't want the staff to have to...
That's what I was leading to in my section.
And there are other things that we've learned too as well. Things about how frequently Google came to us, for example, and said, we'll only allow you to update your information once a month. And that's unhelpful to us because we make some scheduling changes and that could be result in some inaccurate information to customers. We update our site once a week as opposed to once a month. We found out after getting a few other copies that at least one other transit property has been able to negotiate that. So we have the message loud and clear about the need to move forward quickly on this. So,
what we certainly can commit to you, Mr. Graham, is we can be fully prepared with our application. We can have the Denver application model, the Denver model application absolutely prepared by a date certain, and I think that's helpful then. If we've pledged to you that date certain, it's helpful in our negotiations to say, we're ready, you're improving us.
What would be that date certain?
I would suggest January 1st, and let me tell you why, because we have a general plan, given some of the other things that Mr. Zimmerman has told us he would like to have. Our general to have other things.
What is it?
What is he like?
I don't know. He's hearing it too.
So we have a general web.
Where my opinion matters any more than anyone else's here.
But well, they have to do with NextBus as well. We're talking about web applications in general. Our general plan right now is that we are putting the real time, we're integrating the real time NextBus information into our trip planner so that for trips of 2 hours or less where the real-time NextBus information is available, the trip planner will reflect a real-time predictive data rather than a scheduled data, which is an advance. And Mr. Zimmerman has said...
The reason you're doing that is because the board wants it. I may have articulated it, but you're only doing it because the board wants it.
I've made that mistake before, so I should... I've said that before, and you've given me the same counsel before, that you are simply the...
And if they don't agree, it doesn't matter what I think.
That's correct. Okay. So as a as an advocate, you have also...
Okay.
Let's move.
Finish my point.
Yeah, I think Mr. Graham does have a floor.
I just want to explore the point that Mr. Albert made earlier. And that is on the indemnification. How many of the systems that you know of that use Google Transit have an indemnification?
You know, I can't give you the answer to that question because we only receive a few agreements. So of
received
those
two, I heard.
Yes, and so of those agreements, at least one of them, and just one for us.
San Francisco Muni has the agreement. Or if I cannot have.
We can always, you know, you can always call these places.
That's what we've done.
In addition to writing a letter.
Yeah. We call them. We followed up with phone calls
as well as letters. And they won't answer the simple question whether they have an indemnification.
It's one of these things where they want to go way over.
Well, you would know that better than us. But what? Let's explore just for a minute. If you could flesh out just what the indemnification is. I mean, what are we concerned about? What are the consequences that we want to?
So, for example, if we were to have provided them data, some kind of scheduling data, and there may be some bug in it or something like that, that bug gets transmitted over to Google, and you as a customer download that, and somehow you get a bug into your system that causes some kind of damage, that instead of you're going after Google, you'd be going after us. putting WMATA on the hook for whatever damage you downloading Google's transit.
Are there lawsuits potentially?
Sure. I don't know.
Are there lawsuits? I mean, those of you who are more technologically oriented, is that happening?
It is. Mr. Graham, it's very remote from my real life, from my real life experience.
Real life, yeah.
It is very remote, but my understanding is as a condition, however minor, of the compact of being a compact that we're not allowed to take those kinds of things with that haven't done with patients associated.
Compact? Yes.
What is it? There is always the opportunity, the chance that there is some liability, and we just want to minimize that in case Google does something wrong.
Generalized concern. So it's not. We don't have. Do we have other particular and specific concerns?
Is this regarding? I think the probability is very remote that anyone ever come after us as a result. Even nevertheless,
well, it sounds like this is ought not to be a major impediment.
We don't believe it will
other
be.
Other agencies have overcome it.
If I could hear more about a specific concern that we really needed to address, you know, I would be more sympathetic to the need for absent that.
I think it's not the need for indemnification.
I mean, the general caution,
not indemnifying them.
No, I understand that. I think general caution is commendable, and I'm not disagreeing with that. But I would think more of this if there were specific, particular concerns that we wanted to indemnify against.
Mooney, for example, has we have that contract, and I've read the particulars as has Sarah, and they sign up full bore to indemnify if there's any problem. They had no difficulty signing. San Francisco Mooney had no difficulty at all signing a Google clause that said they did have responsibility, they did take this.
So that was the one of the two that did.
Yes.
But the other one didn't, to the bar.
Yeah, that's correct. That we have today.
That we have so far, yeah. Okay. Mr. Litton.
I don't know about, you know, some of you, but as a board member and having an authority and having dealt with agreements and lawyers, I would hope that my lawyer would represent me and suggest that we need to identify ourselves to protect ourselves from risk. I would find it, you know, I would look for another lawyer if my lawyer would suggest that I just open myself up to that kind of exposure. And having been involved in a number of multi-million-dollar agreements where those issues become very significant issues before agreements are signed, I would, one, never put ourselves in a position where we're tying our hands unless it was mutually bound by both parties and where both parties had to come to an agreement on this issue or the opportunity for settlement would go away. I would never enter into an agreement for an authority where we have legal responsibility to suggest that we would just, when we have an opportunity, particularly when another transit authority has been able to receive the same deal. And I would not want to impose a deadline. I would want Google to know that if someone else has received this, WMATA is just as valuable and we should have the same rules and same opportunity as another transit agency, and we should not have less of protection than anyone else. So that would be the direction that I would want to give our team.
Sven.
I guess I'm either confused or ignorant on this issue. And I'd like to go back to basics for a moment. All of our data are available for whoever wants to use it, you said, including Google. And many other people use it. What is it about Google that forces us to have an agreement to do what other people are doing without an agreement?
idea of push versus, so what Google wants, and it's different from what the other developers are doing, is Google wants us to push the data, push everything that's been developed, and to be the ones kind of bearing the burden of continuing to send our asset to them. What the developers are doing is pulling our data, manipulating it, or reformatting it into a product, and they are the ones who are taking that responsibility for making sure that that data gets updated and that they craft whatever it is that works for them in their own way. And so it's a faster way of doing it, actually. If you're a developer, you simply go to our website, you click on bring our terms and conditions, and then you go ahead and...
Okay, so there are terms and conditions that everybody agrees to. And Google is saying yes or no to those basic terms and conditions, or is that not part of the starting point?
They weren't interested in that approach.
At all? Okay. So they don't want to use the data that we've already made available, is what you're telling me.
Not in the way, not according to our terms and conditions, not in that structure.
Okay, so they will use the data, but not in accordance with our terms and conditions?
That's right.
So the issue is our terms and conditions, not the data itself.
Right.
So it's not the push or pull, it's the terms and conditions that we're establishing.
Our terms and conditions are very benign, extremely benign. They basically say you take it as is, you take it without, take our data as is, you take it without warranty, we get to remove our data whenever we want. Google's press is they want us to do the work of making the data available. We want Google to do the work of manipulating the data in whatever way they want. So we make it available in Google format to everybody, including Google, but Google would like us not only to sign up for their terms and conditions, but they would like us to have to reformat and present the data in ways that make it easy for them to enter it into their application.
So you're
we want everybody to have the data, but to do the work of, if they want to remanipulate or reformat from the standard Google format, for them to do it.
Okay, you're telling me that this, I'm still trying to figure out the basics here and what's driving this whole issue. What you're telling me is that the data are out there in Google format, but not in format that's acceptable to Google?
That's essentially correct. It's in Google format, but it has not been reformatted again to be immediately accepted by Google's application.
Okay, so they want us to do additional work.
That's correct.
That's the story.
Okay.
That's the, yeah.
All right, and is this really difficult work or is this real simple work?
It doesn't matter.
I just want to get some idea. I hear where you are.
There is no work of this kind that in and of itself alone is difficult work, but we have we only have a certain amount of resources, and if every day we do a Google-like thing, soon we are exhausted of resources.
I understand, and anything can, if done to the extreme, can cause a major problem. But once we do this reformatting and we set up a program to do the reformatting, is there anything else we would have to do for them to be able to draw this data? Do we have to do this on a regular basis?
Yes, and we have to maintain. If they make any changes, we have to make changes. We have to take a piece of our resource and attach it to doing this kind of work ongoing.
Okay, so you're saying there, one of the issues for us is that there's a cost to us on a continuing basis to format the data for Google. And we have got to decide that it's worth it to us to pay that cost in order to have this available at Google. Yes? And is there another issue associated with, and when we finish doing all of this, they want us to indemnify them if we made a mistake?
That's correct.
Are there any other issues of significance in this? Those are the two issues.
Those are the two issues.
Thank you. At least I understand
that. So if indemnification was resolved, the question is, what would this cost us, which is a new thing introduced today that I hadn't heard before, and I'd love to see that quantified. That's definitely
I think the discussion that we're having, and I think it started in that we wanted to see this access as soon as possible, responding to some particular need. It seems like it's a a valid focus to say we would like to try and have this as a provision to our customers, but to the extent that we will incur more cost and time and risk to no additional benefit that can cover that cost and time and risk, I'm kind of lost into how far we're into this discussion. That, to me, that makes it a separate competitive agreement that we should be in versus what we have accepted for all of the others. And we need to see a benefit for going into that. I think there's a, I'm kind of lost as to why we would want to if we cannot derive the benefit.
You know, I've had my name all plastered on blogs and everything else every time I've raised this issue, and as long as they get it spelled right, I don't really care. But part of my concern has always been the same issue in terms of rewards, expenses, and revenue. The last time I looked at Google's stock price, they're doing okay, and they drive, their money is driven from advertising. The number of hits that go to their site determines how they get rated by advertisers and the prices that they charge for that. So they are in fact using us as an opportunity to get additional hits. And in exchange for that, we want to have, let our staff go out, okay, no identification, not be concerned about protecting our own interests, not being concerned about our own assets because it's a public good. Well, it's a public good to us, but we're paying for their private interests. And I think we need to think about that and not be just rushing because there's this popular view that others have Google, but we do not. Others are not getting advertising revenue, and we are. Others have not gone down the direction of looking at where can we get additional revenues for our riders so we don't have to raise fares. And it just drives me crazy when, you know, I get all this popular view that we should open our arms and just give the millionaire whatever he wants. I have a real concern with that.
Well, Mr. Linton, I'd say I don't think anyone here is advocating that. The agreement I thought all around the table was we shouldn't expose our agency to any risk. And the reason we've moved this far is because we discovered that other agencies had that concern too and managed to get an agreement with Google that didn't require them to, you know, provide that indemnification. So I don't think there's any issue about that because we're all agreed on that point, I believe. So the question is, you know, what other benefits and risks are there associated with this? You cited the fact that we make some money from web advertising. Well, I'm glad for every creative thing the people in this agency have found to do to make a dollar anywhere. But if you look at the sheet that, you know, we were just provided, if you look at what was shown, you can see, you know, we've made between $50,000 and $70,000. The estimate this year is around $66,000. This is, you know, a $2 billion organization we run here. 2% increase in ridership would wipe this out in a second. So, you know, in terms of where we really bring revenue in from, we bring revenue in when people are in seats on our trains and buses. Anything that puts more people in seats on trains and buses brings more revenue. And so, you know, I think that's our number one consideration. The fact is, of the dozen agencies that are surveyed on this other table we were given, the other 11 of them all have some, you know, link in with Google. That is to say, you can use Google in order to do it. Now, I'm fully sympathetic with your view of, you know, who's doing well in this country right now and who isn't. And, I don't think we should be doing them any favors. But the fact of the matter is, this has become, almost ubiquitous access point for people every day in getting information. I'm not interested in advertising for them, promoting them, but the reality is, our audience out there is using it, and I think it's important to understand why this might be of value to them. I do want to know what it would cost us to do, but all this time we've done this, you know, it's been almost a year now. I still haven't seen staff show me anything that says, oh, it'll cost us X dollars to do this. All these other agencies have financial problems too, but I think they may have found that it was advantageous for them to do so. And let me, I'd like to kind of show you why. Would you please put up on the screen the web?
Is there a particular site?
Yes, I'm on Google. Put it up. Take me to Boston. Go to Google Transit, please, and because somebody doesn't necessarily know the website of the transit agency. That's the problem. Most people going to another city do not know that there is a transit agency with a website. And so they're most likely first going this way. And if you go to the city and you want to get around, and probably most people in this room have already done this for a car trip. You do it probably even when you're traveling around here. Now, there are other sites, and some people have other ones and all that, but more and more people are, you know, using this site, and that's the reality. And if you were trying to go from here to, you know, someplace in Rockville or Tyson's Corner, you'd plug in the addresses, and it would tell you how to drive there and what roads to take. But if you want to do it on transit right now, it doesn't help you, except if you were going somewhere else, like, let's say, Boston. And let's say you were going to the conference, that the Railvolution conference at the end of this month, and you were flying into Logan Airport, and you were then going to go to the conference. Show us. So I'm going to start at Logan Airport.
No, this is the MBTA.
Yeah, this is not. Well, this is not what we want to be, but yeah.
That's what the link
well,
is.
Your link tab.
Yeah. Link tab to you.
Howard Square to Logan.
Okay, so just change that, Harvard Square, change that to Logan. And then the destination, put 425 Summer Street, which I happen to know is the location of the Westin where the conference is being held. One S Street, not two. By public transit, No, that's in Boston. Okay, so it's number two. Did you mean that one? Yep. And there it is. And if you see, it says to take the Silver Line from the terminal, and you can see, you know, it's the same thing you get with a car trip, but it's telling me, you know, pretty close to instantly how I can use public transit to get from a place. And it's particularly useful to a traveler, because living in this city, I know the, you know, the Metro Trip Planner and all that. But when I go someplace else, I don't know about that. And if you're somebody who's not working in transit, you might not even think about it. But you might think, how do I get from the airport? And you're likely to be on this site, because that's just the reality. And so, you know, this gives somebody coming from out of town an opportunity to use our transit system. And, you know, perhaps even on buses especially, which travelers find very hard to use. And this one of the biggest obstacles. Our rail system, you know, the map is iconic. The locations are, you know, people tend to find it. But they go to you go to another city, using a bus system is really hard. This makes it a lot easier. And, you know, 5 years from now, maybe they'll be gone and somebody else will have taken over. 10 years, I don't know. But right now, this is a thing that's practically ubiquitous, and I think would get people visiting the Washington area to use the transit system more. And as I said, if it's a 2% increase, you'd make more revenue off that than all the web advertising revenue for the year. So that's why I think it's worth our pursuing, even though I agree that we have to make sure we are legally protected, we can't expose ourselves and our constituents to, you know, any inordinate risk. But all these other agencies managed to do it, so it doesn't seem like it's that far-fetched. And I'd hate for us to be the only place in America that doesn't have this advantage when tourism is, if anything, more important, travel is more important, business travel, to our region than any other city.
Thank you. Indemnification. We can absolutely commit to have the application available side by side January 1st. We can absolutely commit to give you the cost of what but continued maintenance would be, and we can, and we certainly will do the negotiation for to see if we can waive the indemnification.
Well, yeah, we're not committing to January 1. We're going to put all of this on yet until we get the...
No, I said the indemnification.
We should be ready.
Yeah, we're ready on our
end. Our end will be ready, yes.
Trying to be clear on that.
By the way, did you notice it's 15 minutes and a four-minute walk from the airport to where this conference is being held? That's what I call a transit-accessible conference. Mr. Linton.
That's great. that's great.
You know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, I've spent my whole career focusing on this policy. But, you know, I also look at the... I actually spoke at the marketing conference at APTA. They had a representative from Google out here. And there were a number of transit agencies at the time that were talking about entering into the Google arrangement. So I asked a couple of them, I said, well, you know, did you ever consider the fact that there could be some revenue opportunities here? And they said, no, we didn't. We did it because everybody else was doing it. And they said if we knew that other transit agencies would make the effort to see if we could negotiate a deal, then we would have done so. And that's very typical of this industry. One in which, you know, SEPTA did it, CTA has done it, so, you know, we want to do it. So I just think, you know, I just want to provide some context. I didn't just raise this out of a vacuum. You know, I have had some discussions with some of the other agencies who have pursued this. And they pursued it with open hands, no opportunity, and no discussion about negotiating a deal. But what happened is once everybody else did for nothing, and everybody else wanted to follow suit, then one, they lost their negotiating ability, but some of them didn't even want to take it on. So I commend you. Okay.
For discussion? Thank you. Look forward to subsequent report and hopefully some success. That will conclude the work of this committee. Mr. Graham, did you have a motion?
Yeah.
Can we handle before the executive session? Can any of this be handled in 15 minutes?
Oh, yes.
Okay. I think then, just to conclude this committee, I'll turn over to Mr. Graham, and I think we're going to need to be going to a full board closed session prior to our, since we're done a little bit earlier. Mr. Graham.
Okay. Do I have to convene that?
Yeah, okay. So we're adjourned here.
Okay. I call